Good day. Today is Wednesday, 1st July 2026, and before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. Now, over the last 24 hours, events on the Ukrainian battlefields have started to gather pace, and even as the commentaries on the part of many people in the West continue to stick with the story about Ukraine regaining the initiative, pushing back the Russians becoming exhausted and weak. Well, even as that narrative continues, events on the ground increasingly refute it. One person who seems to realise this, perhaps better than other people, is the commander-in-chief of Ukraine's armed forces, who is, of course, General Sirski. Now, Sirski was appointed around 2 years ago to command the Ukrainian military by President Zelensky, precisely because Sirski is somebody who has reliably fulfilled Zelensky's orders without pushing back or contradicting them, and who up to now has also reliably repeated whatever story Zelensky wants to come up with. But I've noticed that over the last few days, Sirski himself is starting to go off message. So, for example, he has said previously that Ukraine is not facing a threat from Belarus. There's no evidence that Belarus or the Russian forces in Belarus are preparing to attack Ukraine. He has now flatly contradicted his chief, Zelensky, by publicly disputing Zelensky's story that the Russians and the Belarusians have switched off the drone relay stations in Belarus, which Zelensky about 2 weeks ago demanded that the Belarusians switch off, warning them that if they didn't, there would be an attack by Ukraine on Belarus, an attack which Zelensky called off, saying that there was no need for it, because, according to Zelensky, the Russians and the Belarusians had heeded his threat and had switched off the relay stations. Sirski says that the relay stations are still functioning and that they continue to be used by the Russians to guide their drones, which conduct operations in western Ukraine. Sirski has also increasingly spoken about extreme manpower shortages by the Ukrainian army. He says this is the most critical problem that Ukraine is facing. And again, he has contradicted Zelensky's story that the Russians are losing more men every month than they are recruiting. Sirski has come out and has said that, in fact, the Russian army in Ukraine continues to grow in strength, and he has put its number at, I believe it was 720,000 men in total. So Sirski has been saying all of these things. He's also now come forward and said something else. He says that, to his knowledge, the Russian high command has now received an order, presumably from Putin himself, to prepare a new operation against Kiev itself, against the Ukrainian capital, Kiev, and that this will take the form of a Russian advance, a new Russian advance into Ukraine's Chernigov region in northeastern Ukraine, presumably from the adjoining Bryansk region. Now, some Russian commentators have rejected this last claim of Syrsky's. I am not so sure, for the simple reason that I have been hearing from one source in particular about a Russian build-up in Bryansk region and about Russian preparations for some kind of incursion from Bryansk region into Ukraine's Chernihiv region for some time. So whilst that obviously doesn't confirm what Syrsky is saying, it does seem to point in that direction. Now, why is Syrsky doing all of this? Well, about 3 weeks ago, rumours were circulating in the international media that Zelensky had told the visiting US Senator, Richard Blumenthal, that he had made a decision to sack Syrsky and appoint in his place Kirill Budanov, Ukraine's former military intelligence chief, who is now Zelensky's political chief of staff. This was supposedly what Zelensky told to Blumenthal. It's never, as far as I know, been contradicted. Zelensky said that this appointment of Budanov to this post would take place in the autumn. It's not clear why. But anyway, perhaps Syrsky is aware that he is going to be sacked fairly soon and is going to be replaced by Budanov. And he wants to clear the decks, tell us what the truth is before he finally leaves his post and wants everybody to know that the realities are that the situation is not as rosy as Zelensky has been saying, so that if Budanov comes in and says that all the problems are Syrsky's fault, Syrsky has already explained before he was sacked that that is simply not true. So that may be and probably is part of the reason. Syrsky, after all, cannot be unaware of these rumours that Zelensky is planning to sack him and to appoint Budanov in his place. On that point, by the way, let me just again reference a point I have made in previous programs. What an eccentric decision it would be to appoint someone like Budanov, who is a former special forces and intelligence officer, never an officer charged with command of large numbers of forces. How strange a decision it would be for Zelensky to appoint Budanov, of all people, to Syrsky's role. But anyway, that's a topic I've discussed in previous programmes. Let's put it aside for the moment. The other obvious reason why Syrsky would be saying these things about the situation on the battlefronts getting worse is because, in fact, they are indeed getting worse. And as I said, we've seen further evidence of this over the last 24 hours. Now, I've noticed that the Russian Defense Ministry continues to talk about clear-ups of Ukrainian forces in Konstantinovka and Liman. They have, however, stopped giving numbers for the number of buildings that the Russians are clearing in Konstantinovka, which strongly suggests that the clearing operation in Konstantinovka has essentially ended. I suspect that the same is true in Liman. They have given a figure for the number of buildings in Liman that the Russian military has cleared over the last 24 hours. It is well down on what we have seen previously. I expect that the clearing operation in Liman is also all but over. It may take still a few days for the Russian Defense Ministry to confirm that Konstantinovka and Liman are fully under control. Often the Russian Defense Ministry, for its own reasons, likes to do this. It likes to keep us all waiting for this kind of announcement, but it's no doubt that the announcement will come. And the reality is that Konstantinovka and Liman, at least in my opinion, have been under Russian control, effective Russian control, for some time. There are reports that similar things are now taking place in other places. The last 48, 72 hours have seen a sudden quickening of the pace of the Russian offensive in Zaporozhye region. The Russians have now announced the capture of more places in Zaporozhye region. They've announced this morning the capture of a village called Kupani. Small place, but a whole cluster of villages have been captured by the Russians over the last couple of days. Northeast of Orekhov, it looks as if the Russians are now moving, and moving quite fast again, and they are approaching the main road, the main supply road, providing supplies to Orekhov from the north. And as I discussed in recent programs, they seem to have largely encircled the town, the small town of Pokrovskoye in this region, whose fall would also lead inevitably to the fall of the other small town of Velikomikhailovka, which is located somewhat to the east. Anyway, an acceleration of the Russian advance, and there are also reports that the Russians are pushing now harder towards Orekhov from the south and from the west. It does increasingly look like the encirclement operation for Orekhov is indeed now underway. And the iron rule of battles in Ukraine is that when the supply roads to a town that the Ukrainians hold have been cut, then the town itself falls quite quickly. And I have no reason to doubt that this will also be true of Orekhov. So we have that news, and we've also now had apparently video confirmation of Russian control of the village of Malinovka, which is located to the east of Kramatorsk. And of course, Putin has told us that there is already fighting now underway in Kramatorsk itself. But yesterday, last night, there was an intriguing story, and I stress story, which is circulating, but which I've not been able to confirm in any official Russian source. This is that Group of Forces Center, the Russian group of forces that captured Pokrovsk at Mirnograd, has now broken through and reached the town of Dobropolye, which is a town to the northeast of Pokrovsk, to northwest, sorry, of Pokrovsk, and west of the Slavyansk Kramatorsk conurbation, and that it is now in the process of beginning a storming operation of Dobropolye. I have to say that when I heard those reports, read those reports, lots of doubts came to mind. I mean, this would be a sudden jump in Russian positions from what we know them to have been previously. But perhaps what we thought we knew wasn't really true. And maybe the Russians were much closer to Dobropilia than we were aware, just say. And maybe alternatively, this is another diversion operation from the Russians intended to force the Ukrainians to reassign troops to defend Dobropilia, and that there isn't a serious Russian plan to capture Dobropilia. Or maybe all of these reports about the Russian advance on Dobropilia, maybe they're just untrue. Maybe they are fictions spread by various Russian reporting channels. I would say that some of the sources that are repeating these claims, all on the Russian side, have proved reliable in the past, and we will see what the truth is. But if the Russians have indeed reached Dobropilia, and if fighting is indeed taking place on the outskirts of this town, then it is a major crisis for the Ukrainians. It would mean that the cauldron that the Russians are in the process of creating around Slavyansk and Kramatorsk is well on the way to being established. If Dobropilia falls together with Liman and Konstantinovka, then essentially Slavyansk and Kramatorsk are encircled. And, well, none other than Vladimir Putin, in that big summary of the situation on the battlefields that he gave to his journalist friend Pavel Zarubin a few days ago, made the further point that beyond Dobropilia, there are basically no established Ukrainian defence lines and fortifications at all. I have to say that I still remain very doubtful that this report that appeared last night can possibly be true. So let's perhaps not put too much weight on it. Let's focus instead on what we know, which is that in Zaporozhye region and in the Slavyansk, Kramatorsk area, and Konstantinovka and Liman, the Russian noose is indeed tightening, and that the fall of Donbass is indeed coming. And, well, in Britain, we have a commentator, Professor Michael Clarke, who regularly gives updates about the situation in the war on Sky News. Some of the updates that he's given have been very remarkable indeed in the past. I remember there was one moment during the war, early on in the war in 2022, when he gave the impression that the Ukrainians were on the brink of encircling the entire Russian army that was engaged in the special military operation. So anyway, let's say it like this. Professor Clarke cannot be accused of being pro-Russian. But anyway, I noticed that he's now acknowledging that there is a real possibility that the Russians will indeed capture the whole of Donbass by the end of this year. And that is an important admission coming from someone like him. Anyway, that's the situation on the front lines. There's also lots of things taking place in the sky. The Ukrainians conducted another big drone strike on Russia last night. They also conducted a big drone strike towards Crimea and the southern regions of southern Donetsk, Zaporozhye as well. The drone strike on Russia seems to have been almost completely ineffective. It appears that the Russians managed to down all the Ukrainian drones. Perhaps one or two got through. I understand that there was pictures of one drone landing or hitting a residential building somewhere in Russia. But overall, the drone attack this time seems to have been, again, another one of the drone attacks that Ukraine has carried out over the last week, which doesn't appear to have achieved its objective. And, well, the drone strike towards the south did have one important success in that it destroyed a bridge, I believe, in eastern Zaporozhye region, which no doubt does have some sort of logistical importance. But again, overall, one gets the sense that the attack was mostly unsuccessful, and that the kind of damage that we have seen being done on Crimea and other places was not repeated over the course of this attack. Some are saying that this was the sixth night in a row when Ukraine has launched lots of drones against Russia or Russian-controlled territory, but without achieving the kind of successes that it has achieved or it has claimed to have achieved in the past. I can remember about 3 weeks ago, Vladimir Putin saying in response to, I think it was comments from journalists, that the Ukrainian drones were actually relatively easy to shoot down or to bring down, that they were slow and operated at low altitudes, that if Russian air defences had been properly organised, the effect of the Ukrainian drone offensive would have been greatly reduced. He seemed to be blaming the previous chief of Ukraine's air defence, of Russia's air defence, General Avzalov, for not preparing properly for Ukraine's drone offensive. General Avzalov was sacked. His replacement, obviously, was given the order to sort out this problem. It looks as if he might have done so, in which case the effectiveness of the Ukrainian drones has reduced. I don't think one can say that this is a permanent change. Whatever it is that the Russians are doing, which is helping them to bring down the Ukrainian drones, the Ukrainians, or to be more precise, their Western allies, are sure to be working to counter. Probably we will see more Ukrainian drone attacks against Russia in the future, with more drones getting through, and some of these drones at least doing actual damage. But for the moment, it looks as if the impact of these drones, the long range and the medium range drones, has been significantly reduced. The same is not true of battlefield drones. On both sides, these continue to remain deadly. But the Russians have now displayed battlefield radars, which they are supposedly producing and which have been distributed to the troops and which are intended apparently to track the movements of Ukrainian drones and to presumably make it possible to more easily to shoot them down. The technology for this, as I understand it, is not particularly difficult. Radars, small battlefield radars carried by ground troops and artillery to track shell movements, have existed since the 1960s and presumably can be adapted to deal with drones as well. Just saying. But anyway, I'm not going to spend time debating this, but perhaps this is going to be the key that is going to unlock the problem of the drones on the battlefields. And anyway, the Russians are now apparently producing these radar sets and they are appearing. I also, by the way, saw a report in the Russian news agency TASS about the Russians now developing a heavy drone analogous to the heavy drones that the Ukrainians have. The reason that has been given in the past for the Russians not deploying heavy drones in the way that the Ukrainians do is because supposedly they lack an analog to the Ukrainian, to the Starlink system, the American Starlink system that the Americans use. I devoted a significant proportion of yesterday's program to what I judge to be informed speculations that the Russian analog to Starlink, the Rasvet system, is now starting to come into operation. I discussed the fact that optically guided Garand drones had been used to conduct a strike on MiG fighter jets at a Ukrainian airfield, which did seem to suggest that something analogous to the Starlink system, which can only be the Russian Rasvet system, is now in operation to guide and control the drones. And this information about a heavy drone now being deployed by the Russians on the battlefronts, I believe from memory that his designation is RM-70, that perhaps also provides further evidence that at least some parts of the Rasvet system are now in operation. Anyway, we will see. Probably there's still gaps in the coverage and probably there are interruptions in the coverage. It will probably take some time for the system to operate as smoothly and as efficiently as Starlink, but maybe it is operating at some level now, and probably it is starting to make a difference. Anyway, the other thing that the Russians have been continuing to do is to conduct a major operation against Ukraine's energy complex, mostly in eastern Ukraine. And they continue to conduct drone strikes against gas filling stations, petrol stations, if you prefer, across eastern Ukraine. Ukraine apparently has 6,000 petrol stations in total. Reports have spoken of the Russians having destroyed 200 of them. So if that's the actual number, then only a very small fraction of these petrol stations have indeed been destroyed, just saying. But perhaps the true number destroyed is much greater. Perhaps the focus of the destruction has been mostly along certain arterial routes in eastern Ukraine, linking, providing supplies to Kharkiv and Sumy and the Donbass towns. So maybe the effect is greater, or maybe just saying the Russians have actually destroyed many more gas filling stations or petrol stations than some reports say. Of course, the Russians are said to have amassed thousands of Garand drones, and it could be if the RASVET system is indeed operational at some level, that some of these several thousand of these drones will be equipped with optical guidance systems, and it may be that we're going to see an escalation of the offensive against these petrol stations over the next few weeks or months. But anyway, one can always speculate, and I don't want to speculate too far beyond actual knowledge. So, anyway, the Russians continue with those methodical attacks, which are clearly intended to dismantle Ukrainian logistics in eastern Ukraine. And they continue to attack the railways, and they continue to go after the locomotives in particular. And as I've said already, because of the wider gorge of the Ukrainian railways, destroyed locomotives are all but impossible for the West to replace. It's very difficult to see how something like that could be done. But anyway, the other thing is that the Russians have conducted other strikes against energy facilities across Ukraine as well. And this was done last night. And the Ukrainian Air Defense Command says that the Russians used about 150 Garand drones. And they say that Kiev was particularly affected, and that several districts of Kiev have had their electricity supply cut. And the Ukrainians also say that their state electricity company, Ukrenergo, is going to impose a complete shutdown of electricity supplies across Ukraine for a 5-hour period from 1700 hours Ukrainian time until 2200 hours Ukrainian time. Now that is intriguing, and it does beg a lot of questions because the Russian attack does not seem to have been particularly powerful last night. Is the Ukrainian energy system so depleted and so fragile now that even a relatively small attack will disable it to this extent? Or could it be that the Ukrainians need to shut down the system for a certain period of time because urgent repairs have to be done to it? And that requires, for some strange reason, a shutdown of the entire system across the whole territory of Ukraine. That does itself seem extraordinary, by the way. Or could it be, as some are speculating, that the Ukrainians are expecting the big Russian strike, maybe using the Oreshnik system that I discussed in my program yesterday, that they are expecting it to happen precisely between these times, 1700 hours and 2200 hours local time, and that this switch off is in some way connected to Ukrainian preparations in advance for that attack? Again, I don't pretend that I understand the reasoning here. Why, if the Russians are going to conduct a big attack between those hours, is it necessary in advance to shut down the entire Ukrainian energy system? Well, no doubt there are explanations. I'm not going to explore them further. But I would say that it is interesting, again, that the media in the West has been talking so extensively over the last few weeks about energy shutdowns in Russia and fuel shortages in Russia, and talks so much less about the very, very heavy cutdowns, much bigger cutdowns in electricity and fuel supply that appear to be happening in Ukraine. Anyway, put all that aside, Vladimir Putin some days ago said that by the first week of July, he expected the energy situation, the fuel situation in Russia, to mitigate, to stabilize. For the moment, that appears to be happening. The Russian Central Bank has published a statement about the overall price situation in Russia. They say that oil prices rose, partly in response to the general worldwide rise in oil prices following the start of the Iran-US 40-day war and the closure of the Strait of Hormuz. Again, as I said already, many people, when they see oil prices rise, assume that for Russia this is automatically a good thing. They tend to overlook the fact that a global rise in oil prices also means a rise in oil prices within Russia itself, which usually results in higher inflation. But anyway, the central bank says that the oil price rise in Russia now looks like a blip, that it's falling back again. The seeming fragile reopening of the Strait of Hormuz may have had something to do with it. But overall, it is more likely that in the short term, it's a sign that panic buying of petrol, of gasoline and diesel in Russia is now in decline. Now, to repeat again a point that I made some days ago, that anyway happens for the simple reason that if people fill up their tanks, then obviously they don't have any place to store petrol, gasoline and diesel. So that obliges them, for a time at least, to stop buying. But it does look as if, anyway, the period of panic buying of gasoline and diesel in Russia, which was, by the way, from what I can judge, mostly concentrated in specific areas, that period may be abating, may be ending. Anyway, on that topic, and very briefly, the Russian deputy prime minister, who's in overall charge of the fuel and energy complex in Russia, who is Alexander Novak, has said that the fuel and energy complex in Russia today accounts for just 13% of GDP. He said that previously, until a short time ago, it accounted for 18 to 20% of GDP, but now that apparently has fallen to just 13% of GDP. Russian GDP numbers are always a complex topic because when we talk about Russia, the discrepancy between GDP at exchange rate values, what some people call nominal GDP and GDP at purchasing power parity levels is so extreme, more extreme than I know in terms of any other economy. And the IMF and the World Bank, by the way, have both said that all Russian GDP numbers are probably wrong and may understate the size of Russian GDP by as much as a third. Just saying. So it could be that when Novak tells us that GDP, that the proportion of GDP, the proportion of Russia's GDP made up by the oil and gas industry is now 13%, not 18 to 20% or 40% or 50%, as many people think. He's actually still overstating it. It could be less. And my own back of the envelope calculations suggest that it is well below 10%, just to say. But I'm not going to discuss this in any more detail in this program. Suffice to say that the universal belief in the West that if you strike at Russia's energy complex, you're going to create an economic collapse in Russia, that Russia is a gas station masquerading as a country. The famous phrase, trope, invented a few years ago by Senator McCain. Well, that has never really been true, and it is absolutely and emphatically not true anymore. Since I'm talking about Russian economic matters, I would say that we've also had another piece of economic news this morning, which has come as a genuine surprise to me. There was a contraction in the Russian economy in January, followed by a smaller contraction in February. Then in March and April, there was a significant recovery. However, in May, the economy softened again, and I suggested that this was probably connected with the very high interest rates. I discussed this in a recent program. But, well, as it turns out, it looks as if in June we had a renewed recovery, because we now have PMI for industry in March, and I'm one of these people who considers Russian PMI figures probably the best overall guide to what is actually happening in the economy. And to my surprise, PMI in industry, the industrial PMI readout in Russia for June was 50.3. The first time PMI for industry in Russia has been above 50 for a fair amount of time now, and apparently the highest reading since February 2025, suggesting renewed industrial growth in Russia in June. So all sorts of things are happening in the economy, which are not perhaps always easy to understand, and which I will touch on later in the program. But anyway, to repeat again, for the moment at least, it seems as if the current period of fragility, or shall we say overstretch, in the Russian fuel situation may be ending, even at the same time as it appears to be getting worse in Ukraine itself, as a result, presumably, of Russian drone attacks. Meanwhile, the Russians, for their part, continue to make clear that in terms of negotiations with the United States remain at a standstill in relation to the conflict with Ukraine, and that negotiations with the Europeans, with the European Union, are not only merely at a standstill, they are actually positively undesirable. We've had some statements to this effect from the Deputy Speaker of the Russian Federation Council, Konstantin Kozachev, who is the head of the Federation Council's International Affairs Committee. And of course, the Federation Council is the upper house of the Russian Parliament. Anyway, Kozachev, who is a very experienced diplomat and who has perhaps had intelligence connections in Russia, and who actually conducted negotiations for a short time last year with the Americans in the abortive attempt that the Americans made to revive the grain deal in the Black Sea. At the time, I thought that if serious negotiations to end the conflict in Ukraine between Russia and the United States were to begin, negotiations similar to the negotiations that took place in Paris between the United States and North Vietnam, I thought that if such negotiations were ever to happen, Kozachev was a possible, indeed very likely, Russian chief negotiator. Just saying. Anyway, Kozachev, who, as I said, is a senior man, has now spoken, and he's made absolutely clear that the Russians do not want the Europeans anywhere involved in any negotiations on the topic of the conflict in Ukraine at all. This is what he said, and he said this in an interview to TASS. The European Union's role is negligible. It doesn't exist because the European Union is a party to the conflict, and they've said so themselves. If we allow the European Union to join the negotiating table, it will simply strengthen the opposing side. Why on earth would we play such games? I am categorically against the EU participating in any way in the talks on Ukraine. And Kozachev did say that Russia should be willing to conduct dialogue with individual European leaders, but even in that respect, those leaders, say Merz or Meloni or Macron or the new British Prime Minister Andy Burnham, they should not participate in any formal negotiation process with respect to Ukraine either. Now, you could actually, if you wish, and this may not have been Kozachev's intentions, you can take what he said about the Europeans and you could apply it to the Americans as well, because Kozachev says that the reason why the Europeans should not be involved in negotiations on the issue of Ukraine is because, as they made perfectly clear, they are on Ukraine's side, and if they participate in negotiations on Ukraine, all that will do is strengthen Ukraine's negotiating hand. And why would the Russians want that? Well, doesn't the same also apply to the United States? After all, as Marco Rubio recently said, the United States is on Ukraine's side. It continues to provide Ukraine with intelligence. American companies provide Ukraine with drones and have assisted Ukraine in its drone campaign against Russia. Perhaps they've also supplied missiles too, though this remains a little controversial. Couldn't you equally well argue, using Kosachev's arguments, that the United States also should not be involved in negotiations? Because as the events of the last year have demonstrated, the United States is unable to distance itself from Ukraine. It doesn't want to distance itself from Ukraine. It is on Ukraine's side, and therefore its participation in negotiations merely strengthens the Ukrainian position. Now, Kosachev is a very experienced diplomat. He's served in the embassy in Sweden, but perhaps more importantly, he's worked for Russia in various international agencies. He's conducted negotiations, as I said, with the Americans. So I think that, like all Russian officials at his level, he chooses his words very carefully. And isn't this perhaps a message from people within the foreign ministry, from people within the Federation Council, the upper house of the Russian parliament, that Vladimir Putin, please, no more talks with the Americans either? We saw last year that such talks ultimately lead nowhere. We set out our position. We've given this a try. We had that meeting in Anchorage. The Americans came up with all sorts of ideas in Anchorage to which we agreed, but nothing came of them. So let's not press on with the Americans too. Let's just focus on the war, go on fighting it, achieve victory, and forget about the Americans, forget about the Europeans, concentrate instead on defeating the Ukrainians. I am sure that this message is being conveyed right across the system, all the way up to the Kremlin, and I am sure that there are some people there who listen to it. Just saying. Well, in the meantime, even as all European efforts or pretended efforts to become engaged in the conflict in Ukraine have come to nothing, diplomatically engaged things in Europe continue to get worse. Now, a couple of days ago, we had a complete stop for a few hours of the entire German railway system. Now, I am old enough to remember a time when German railways were a byword for efficiency. It's been a very long time since that has been true. The German railway system has for years been starved of investment. German railways have become increasingly unreliable, prone to breakdowns, prone to repeated delays. Customer service, to say it simply, has been awful. And things got even worse. There was some kind of fault, apparently, with the signalling system. And for about 2 hours, the entire system had to be shut down. And when it restarted, well, there were hours of accumulated delays and disruptions across the whole system. Wouldn't it be a good idea for the German government, which still has a certain degree of financial space? Germany doesn't have the enormous debts, or at least is not yet reached the kind of debt levels we see in Britain, Italy, and France. Would it be a good idea for Germany to invest the billions that would be needed to sort out its railway system and every other part of its infrastructure and its economic and industrial system too. Well, Chancellor Merz did promise at the start of this year that there would be indeed a big surge of investment in infrastructure. He was prepared to set aside the debt brake to do that. But we've seen little result from that. And all of the enthusiasm instead has been concentrated on military spending. But military spending isn't delivering anything. Germany, a short time ago, had a very ambitious plan to build destroyers, and they're called frigates, but they're really destroyers because the warships that were planned would have been bigger than America's Arleigh Burke destroyers, to build destroyers in the Netherlands. And Rheinmetall, the big German military industrial company, was supposed to be the lead contractor. But the whole project went nowhere. Costs started to surge. It became very clear very quickly that Rheinmetall was not able to administer the program. And eventually the program had to be cancelled, very much apparently to the dismay and shock of Rheinmetall, and with the probable early sacking of its CEO. And there's now another plan to build rather simpler frigates of a smaller type in German shipyards. I anticipate this program will quickly run into exactly the same difficulties. And of course, there's also been plans to build fifth generation fighter jets. There are all sorts of competing programs in Europe to build those, one led by Britain, one led by Germany, another led by France. So far, there's no sign that any of these programs are moving forward. And if we're talking about European industrial military cooperation intended to produce fighter jets, especially fifth generation fighter jets, which are the most advanced fighter jets, well, I guess we will have to wait at least 20 years before we see those fighter jets actually appear. In the meantime, of course, the Americans, the Russians and the Chinese already have fifth generation fighter jets, which are already in production. The Americans have produced hundreds of them. The Chinese have produced hundreds of them. The Russians, it must be said, have produced significantly fewer of them, but they are producing them. And one gets the sense that production is now rising. And the Russian fifth generation fighter jet has now got a new engine. And that will probably lead to further increases in its production as well. By the time the Europeans complete their project to develop a fifth generation fighter, if they ever do, the others will have moved on to whatever new type of aircraft they decide, new forces, the new air forces need, be it sixth or seventh generation fighter jets or drones or whatever it is. And well, the British government, Keir Starmer, as his parting gift to the British people, has now announced his new grandiose defence investment plan, £15 billion over 4 years. Nobody seriously thinks that it's going to make any difference to the state of the British armed forces. He said that it is impossible to pay for military expansion through debt, and he's warned Andy Burnham, the incoming Prime Minister, not even to think about doing that. And Starmer apparently is going to be mostly about drones. That's now the weapon system that everybody is excited about, even as I've discussed in several programs now, the heyday of the drone, both on the battlefields and in the strategic space in the sky, may be coming to an end. But anyway, that's what it's going to be. And of course, in order to fund this £15 billion programme, which, to repeat again, is over 4 years, Keir Starmer has to cut back spending on other things. Anybody who travels around Britain knows that the state of British roads is becoming increasingly poor, but roads apparently are not going to be renewed or refurbished as they might have been because the funding is needed instead to pay for this new defence programme that Keir Starmer is talking about. The thing about Keir Starmer's £15 billion project is that no one in Britain is happy about it. MPs from constituencies where road development is going to be stopped are furious and are complaining. The military is complaining. The people who want to spend more on the military are complaining. But any cuts on any other sector in order to increase spending further are going to be inevitably unpopular with all sorts of people. The reality is that a major surge in defence spending in Britain and in France and in Italy and in Spain and in sorts of other countries is unaffordable. And in Germany, as I've said, it is not delivering. And well, UBS, the Swiss bank, has now provided us with data which in part explains why. We've had a breakdown from UBS about what has happened in wealth terms in various countries between 2020 and 2025. So we see that in Russia, average wealth per adult has increased by 36.9%, and median wealth per adult, perhaps a more useful guide, has increased by 9.1%. In other words, between 2020 and 2025, during the period of the pandemic, during the period of the special military operation, during the period when Russia has been under extraordinary sanctions pressure, Russians have become richer. Now, this is not the same, by the way, as real earnings. Real earnings in Russia have also increased during this period. This is an increase in actual wealth. Russians are richer than before, and they are earning more than before. Now, what is the situation in the West? Well, we see that in the United States, over the same period, median wealth per adult has shrunk by 19.6%. Average wealth has increased by 9.8%, but average, in this case, probably means that the very, very wealthy have become very much richer as a result of the asset bubble. The same appears to be true in Germany. their median wealth per adult has declined by 19.9%, even as average wealth has increased by 11.6%. Germany is becoming, in other words, a less equal society. But look at the situation. Look at the situation in the major European countries. In France, median wealth has declined by 12.2%, and average wealth has declined by 4.5%. In the Netherlands, average wealth has declined by 14.4%. Median wealth has declined by 26.2%. Average wealth in the Du in the Netherlands, I'm sorry, median wealth in the Netherlands has fallen by a quarter between 2020 and 2025. And in Britain, in some ways, it's even worse. Average wealth has declined by 23.2%. Median wealth has declined by 23.6%. And as I happen to know, real wages in Britain have been flat basically since the 2008 crisis. Britain, France, Germany, the Netherlands are becoming poorer. Russia has becoming richer. That is why Russia is able to absorb real interest rates of 10%, something which no Western economy can do. That is why Russia can produce more weapons, something which Western economies struggle to do. That is why Russia can sustain the war and funding for the war, which is what Western economies cannot do either. You can spin these figures whichever way you choose, but the simple fact is that since the start of the special military operation in 2022, Russia has become richer, Russians have become richer, and Westerners, but especially Europeans, have become poorer. Ultimately, that explains everything about the war up to this time, and I see no reason why that should change. And of course, it conforms completely with the impressions I got whilst I was in Russia, whilst I was in Moscow and Pskov in the 10-day period in the middle of June, which I have talked about so extensively in my programs. Well, that's where I'm going to finish today's program. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X, and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. And please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.